Welcome to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Talk radio to inspire, inform, and stimulate. Bringing you enlightened discussions with authors, creatives, innovative business and health professionals, and ordinary people living extraordinary lives, sharing their expertise and life stories, making a difference one word at a time. Now, here's your host, Vicki St. Clair.
Welcome, everyone. Welcome, welcome. Cornelia Mautz-Bellman is my guest today. She was a family and children's therapist long before turning full-time to writing and art. She's now the author of 10 books for children, including The Way It Feels, which helps kids manage and recognize their emotions. Her latest book is very different. It's a memoir. It's called Missing, and is a very personal quest to understand her deceased mother, who she was, and how an early tragedy in her mother's life impacted Cornelia's own life, something Cornelia terms a family's emotional legacies. She also shares the story of a troubled brother with a habit of disappearing, abandoning both his family and children. Cornelia's earned awards from the Illinois Arts Council. She was a finalist for the Penelope Niven Creative Nonfiction Award and was awarded the Bernard DeVoto Fellowship in Nonfiction at Breadloaf Writers Conference. The book, again, is called Missing, and you can tell by the way that Cornelia speaks when we're talking about the research she did and why she wanted to follow this story to understand her mother better. You can tell it really was a very personal journey for her. And my guest, Cornelia Mautz-Bellman. Cornelia Mautz-Bellman, welcome to the show. Welcome.
Oh, Vicki, nice to be with you.
Very pleased to have you here with your new memoir, Missing. It's about a daughter's quest to find her mother long after her death. So you are a writer. You've written a lot of books. I think, was it 10 children's books?
Yes, at least.
Yeah.
Actually, a couple more, but
And so what inspired you to take a different direction and write a memoir at this point?
Well, they're related, actually, the children's books and this book in a way, because I was a professional therapist for a number of years, and I noticed that my adult clients really didn't know how they felt. If I would ask them sometimes, how does that make you feel? And they wouldn't always know, or they'd say, well, I don't know, I have a headache. And I saw that there was a need for the younger the better people to learn about their emotions. And I realized as I was working on this book, which took me very long time, Vicki, it was a kind of psychological journey for me. But I realized as I was working on it that many of those children's books that I had written in a way for my mother. I wished that she had had them when she was a child. And what I was looking for when I was writing Missing was not looking for her, because she was not actually missing, though there is a missing person in the story. I was trying to understand what happened to her. What happened to her in her life to change her or to alter her from the lovely young woman I saw in her pictures as a young woman to this tiny little 67-pound wrinkled up old thing who had smoked herself to death. And she did literally smoke herself to death. She got lung disease, and she, instead of treating it, and she needed help that she didn't get, I have to say, but she continued to smoke for a decade after she was diagnosed, and she ended up dying in a very sad way at only 63. I needed to understand that, what had happened.
Right. Yeah, I can see the connection there. How did it make you feel when you came to the realization that I've written these books for children, children's picture books, and it was really in search of, you know, for my mom?
Well, it was helpful to me, because all of it is a pursuit for health. It's a pursuit for healthy life, both mental and physical. And I've been pursuing it probably, you know, because my mother was so ill, it seems like I'd been pursuing that for a long time. And being a therapist had been part of that, helping other people to pursue a healthy life, or I guess I should say to develop a healthy life. So, you know, it was not only for her that I wrote those books, but she was just a child when her father died. She was only 7. And she was not helped to deal with it. This, by the way, was everything that I found out as I was writing it. She and I had never talked about it because she didn't talk about things. She didn't talk about her troubles. Of course, if you have a mother who doesn't talk about her troubles, you might end up being a therapist yourself. You know? Because you realize that talking about them, sharing them with somebody that you trust is the way to healing.
Right.
And so the books were, yes, for her, but also for children. I knew that children needed the help the earliest they could get in learning how to not only name their feelings, but manage them. And, of course, I had needed that also. So the title Missing of my memoir is not only about what my mother was missing in her childhood and her growing up, and about my missing brother, but about what I, too, had missed because of the deficits in the way she was parented.
Yeah. Don't you think that generation, though, because, I mean, I think she was like 16 in about 1927. She'd written something in her journal.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And that generation, they just didn't talk about feelings. You know, I can remember my grandmother and my aunt. My aunt was a lot older than my mother. And I can remember both of them saying at times, well, best not to delve into that.
Yeah.
You know, that kind of response.
It certainly was part of it. My mother was born in 1911, for heaven's sakes. And her father died in 1918, which was just at the end of a World War One. World War One. That right. We're talking really long time ago. But he did not die in the war. He died as the only thing she ever told me about his death was that he had died of a ruptured appendix. But I didn't know anything about the story.
Mm.
And, you know, partly that is, Vicki, that until you reach a certain age, you're not necessarily interested in your parents' stories. It's all about you, right? It's all about young person. It's your life. And, you know, you don't want to hear maybe your grandmother's or your mother's stories. But I was 28 when she died, and I wished that we had talked about all these things, but I couldn't do it, and she couldn't do it then.
Yeah, I can only imagine what that must feel like, Cornelia, because I did talk a lot with my mother and my aunt and grandmother, heard loads of stories over the years. Asked tons of questions as I got older and I became a writer myself, you know, and asked, you know, to understand deeper things. I thought I knew everything I wanted to know or needed to know about when she died, when my mother died. I'm like, wow, there's so many questions I still have.
Yeah.
So I can understand you wanting to delve into that and find some answers.
I did. I wanted to find answers. I wanted to create, whether or not it's accurate, of course, is the question. I wanted to create a narrative that made sense to me about what had happened to her. Mm. And my narrative is that when her father died so abruptly and suddenly, and she was not helped to grieve it, that she froze a part of herself, and she never really unfroze it. She loved my father. She loved, I'm sure, her children, but she was emotionally very distant. She was not, you know, the kind of mother who hugs and kisses and talks about her feelings. So I ended up being a mother who hugs and kisses and talks about her feelings probably more than my children ever want to hear.
That's a mother's prerogative. So let's talk a little bit about your mom and tell me what she was like when she was younger. I mean, reading her diaries, she kept diaries, and so you did a lot of work through that. And you've become a diarist yourself. I read you're on your 250th volume?
Yes.
Wow.
Yes.
Wow.
Yes, I've just finished volume 250.
Incredible.
And Yeah, the diaries are kind of a wonderful story in themselves, because I discovered these few, only a few diaries of my mother's from when she was, starting when she was 10, you know, she would keep them for maybe a couple months, and then years would go by and there would be another one. But I think I have three from her teenage years. And they're so amusing. They're so full of life. They're so typical of any teenager, but certainly there are things in them that are particular to that era. But the point is that I wanted to find a way to preserve them beyond my own family, and I happened to learn about the Schlesinger Library on the History of Women in America. It's part of the Radcliffe Institute at Harvard, and I wrote them and said, I have these diaries of my mother's and also some letters and papers and a lot of wonderful photographs from my family. And also, by the way, I write diaries, and I've been writing them since 1981. Would you be interested? And a year went by, and then I got a response. The curator had been actually out on medical leave, and of course, I don't know everything that has to go into their decision-making, but they accepted everything. And they have a collection of diaries of all sorts of people, ordinary people, and their mission is to document the lives of American women.
Wow. That's fascinating.
So it's very thrilling, because my mother's voice in those diaries is being held in perpetuity, if we have a perpetuity and the world doesn't, you know, the planet doesn't disappear on us. And my diaries are closed until the year 2070. So that I can feel free to say what I want.
Yeah, I don't think they'd be interested in mine.
Oh, yes. Well, you know, I've often thought, Vicki, that writing a diary is like having your own private therapist, because you can tell everything that you need to tell, but you do have to be sure that you have a lock and key, or that you're going to do something with them, because you don't want to leave anything behind that would hurt somebody. And of course, we all have feelings, back to feelings, that are not nice to share sometimes. And you can share them with your diary, and you don't have to hurt anybody.
Yeah. My diaries, when I finish with them, go into a banker's box in the garage, and it's sellotaped up very strongly, and on the top it says, for a certain person's eyes only, and his instructions are to burn them.
And will that certain person, what if the certain person doesn't live longer?
Well, that's very true, you know. Then somebody's going to look at my diaries and think, oh my God, Vicky was crazy. Because I do morning pages a lot, which isn't
good.
The same as keeping a diary per se. It's just a way of clearing your brain and getting those random thoughts out down on the page. So they're very abstract, and you might flip from going, you know, oh, I have a pain in my toe, to, oh, what have I got to do? And why do I have to, I can't write anything. I can't think of anything to write for my morning pages. I mean, all over the place. So.
But when you go back and look at them, you must use them for your other writing, don't you? Do you use some of what you've discovered that you were perhaps preoccupied with?
There's one patch that I may do at some point. Yeah, it's too close to the knuckle right now, but you know, when there's a little distance, I may do that.
But so, you know, if we've given enough time, of course all of our diaries would be interesting, and they wouldn't hurt anybody. Nobody would say you were crazy. They'd say, isn't that interesting? Vicki St. Clair wrote this in the year 2022.
Yeah. So I love this, and your mother was writing about her boyfriend Nathan when she was 16. Tell us about that. She ends it with, everything's beautiful.
So
optimistic and so young.
I ended the memoir with that quote, because it made me so happy to think of her standing in the sunshine. I went to Iowa, and I was standing at the doorway of the what was then the library where she had met her boyfriend, Nathan. And, oh, he's so sweet, and everything's wonderful, and life is beautiful, exclamation point. And I loved being able to think of her that way, instead of as this suffering person who, you know, was so burdened by illness and burdened by her guilt about the illness, because, you know, really she needed to be in a rehabilitation, which people didn't do so much. I don't know if they still do it for nicotine addiction. Nicotine addiction is terrible. They say it's as bad as heroin or cocaine. Mm-hmm. And I was a smoker myself for a long time, even after seeing my mother die of lung disease. So I'm well aware of how addictive it is. And luckily, by many repeated efforts, I was able to stop many, many years ago. And I hope I don't have any ill effects. Well, you always have some ill effects. You know, they ask you, did you ever smoke? I said, yeah, well, I stopped, you know, 25, 30 years ago. Yes, well, it still affects your lungs. So.
Yeah.
Anyway.
But better to stop than continue, you know.
Yeah.
And having been married to a smoker myself, when he tried to give up several times, I would willingly buy him a packet and shove them at him sometimes. It's very
hard.
Very tortuous.
I used to sit and cry and think, if only I could smoke. This is the classic addict song. If only I could smoke, everything would be all right.
Yeah.
Which, of course, is the absolute irony, because smoking will make absolutely everything awful.
Right.
Or well, the drinking or the drugging or whatever the person's harmful addiction is. So she, you know, she was an addict.
Yes.
And to nicotine, and she also used tranquilizers and drank too much, and poor thing.
Your father said, you wrote in the book that he said her fury at Nixon and the Watergate scandal was one of the things that infuriated her and actually kept her alive. Her fury kept her alive at some point.
Oh, I believe it. Yeah, she would have, I often think of her in our present times, or luckily past, sort of past times. Yeah, she wrote Nixon letters continually. The only one she ever got an answer to was a false note that she wrote him, telling him how beautiful the uniforms were for the White House Guard, and he sent back a card that was gold engraved, and she posted it on her kitchen funny board. And she hated him in large part because of the Vietnam War and the suffering of the young men,
right,
being slaughtered. That was my generation.
Right. So, talking of your generation, and you were born the youngest, I think, of five children.
Yes.
You wrote that your parents were pretty worn out by the time you came along. What was your childhood like?
Well, you know, it's only in retrospect that I can see it. In some ways, it was a happy childhood, because I was on my own a lot, and so I wrote, and I did art, and I've produced little shows, and I had a lot of fun. You'd think that with four siblings I would have had playmates, but I didn't. We were all kind of on our own. My parents were neglectful, really. They weren't horribly neglectful. I mean, we were fed and clothed, but they just didn't pay that much attention to what was going on, and I was a good kid, as most of us, but not all of us in my family were. And so we managed. But I found recently a picture, my sixth grade picture, that I had signed to my parents, and I felt sad for it. It said, to the most wonderful parents in the world.
Hmm.
And of course, every child feels that. And even when, as I know from having worked in child abuse as a therapist, even the parents who are abusive, children love them because they need them. They don't realize what they don't have until they find what they didn't have.
Right, right.
So, but my mother was a benign person, certainly, and mostly my father was with me, not with the older children. He was not benign with them. But it was an oddly happy childhood that took me many, many years to unravel all the issues that actually, the troubles that were caused by that childhood.
Right. Part of the inspiration for you writing your memoir was former New York editor William Maxwell, who knew your mother quite well. And so he encouraged you to tell this story, right?
He did. He had been friends with my parents at the University of Illinois and long ago, in the 20s. And they were part of what he called a literary set, because it was an agricultural school largely in those days. And my parents had kept him in their sights all these years, although they were not in touch with him, only for a few years after graduation. And I had the chance to meet him when I was 37, which was older than they were when they had been friends with him. And he was just delightful. He was eager to meet me when when I told him who my parents were. And he said, "Oh, I loved you at first sight." He meant that because he saw my parents' faces in me. And he'd been very fond of both my parents, but he thought my father was especially funny and charming and the handsomest man on campus. And over the years in my friendship with Bill, when I had to tell him the truth about my father, yes, he was funny and he was handsome, but he also lacked a lot of character, to put it mildly. And Bill was disappointed, I could tell, you know, to learn this about his friend. And when I told him that my father had put Mother in a nursing home, in part to get her off his hands so he could go off and chase her rich friend, Bill said, "I want you to tell your mother's story. I think it would help make it up to her for what happened to her somehow."
I love that. So let's just dive into that a little bit deeper, because you have a brother who, Frank, he kept disappearing. He was gone most of the time. And it seems there was no real love lost between you and him, because you write at one point that you did want to find him when you were doing your research, but you didn't really want to talk to him.
No, he was 11 years older than I, and actually I didn't know him, and I was a little alarmed by him.
Yeah, in what way? Because I know there was an incident one night when your mother accused or had a, what your father said was a paranoid episode, where she accused your brother of trying to murder them both.
Yes. We thought it was, of course, I was away with my child, living in, you know, 150 miles away when I heard that. And I trusted my father when he said it was paranoia. It never occurred to me until 25 years later, Vicki, when I woke up and one night and sat straight up in bed and thought, "Oh my goodness, maybe he really did try to kill her. He didn't succeed if he did try." Right. And I thought about how it could have happened. Well, my father had invited him to live with them, which was, talk about bad judgment. This was a character who had deserted wives, stolen money, embezzled, and so forth, my brother. And he invited him to live with him, and he did so because he could leave Mother with him. This is before he put her in the nursing home. And so my brother was alone with her, and he knew that he was going to inherit quite a bit of money when she died, because her mother had left a trust fund. And so it is possible that he tried, or it's possible that Mother was paranoid about it. She was put into a nursing home after she said that, and so if he had tried, couldn't try again. All I can tell you about it is that he waited around long enough to get the inheritance. He married his fourth wife, and he left a note for her saying, "I won't be home tonight or ever," and disappeared. And disappeared, and no one knew where he was, and no one wanted to look for him until I was writing the book, and then I found out what happened to him.
And I don't want to really give that away, because it's part of the story, but one thing that struck in my mind, we hear a lot today about ghosting. People ghost each other, you know, they go on three dates and then they never hear from them again. They don't even bother saying, you know, "I'm not interested, you know, have a nice life." But your brother was infamous for doing that, and you asked him at one point, "How could you leave your wife and son?" And he said, it's something to the words effect that it's easy, you just walk away.
Yes, That's what he said. It's easy. You just walk away. He had no conscience, apparently. And I do think Mother had always said that he had had encephalitis as a child and that he was never the same after that. Mm-hmm. And I did do research while I was working on the book. I mean, it is possible, as we know, with various brain disorders, I don't know about that particular one, that, you know, his conscience could well have been affected by a brain disorder.
Right.
Or else he was just whatever people decide a sociopath is.
Right.
But he did not have a conscience. However, he was very attractive, very charming, very nice. It's very alarming to think of how many people there are like that. Like, you know, people write books about people like that.
Yeah.
My book is not about him. I have a friend who's a man who's a writer who said, oh, I would have written a book about that brother. I said, no, I'm not that interested in that brother. I'm interested in my mother's life.
Yeah. So having gone through this, and I know you did a lot of research to try and piece all of this together, do you feel you accomplished what you set out to do? Do you feel that you got to understand your mum and understand her life?
Oh, I do. I've been very satisfied and, what would be the word? I guess at peace about it, because I feel that I have recreated her, Vicki, perhaps in a way I wanted to.
Right.
You know, how accurate is it? I mean, it is based on evidence that I found. It's not conjecture. Her diaries, people who knew her, medical records, you know, letters. But the actual person, if she were in front of me today, how would she feel about the picture that I created? I believe that she would find it accurate, and I hope that she would be touched by it.
I'm sure she would.
As a daughter, I have tried to, and I think I succeeded in bringing her to life.
Yeah, I'm sure she would be very touched by it. I'm wondering if, you know, often when we dig into things and we poke around where we haven't before, we learn things that we wished we hadn't. I'm wondering if that happened to you at any level.
No. Not at all. I think in order to be healthy mentally and physically, one always has to know the truth. And the truth is what I feel I have found. The truth of my family, which is not always pretty.
Right.
But the truth as it was of both good and bad of the people that I come from. And the sadnesses and the triumphs of the people that I come from. My grandfather, Sam, who was my mother's father, who, of course, I never met because he died in 1918, for heaven's sakes, when she was only 7 years old. I feel very fond of him. I feel very connected to him. And I never would have known what I know about him if I hadn't written this book.
Right, right. You mentioned earlier how your father, you know, in many ways was good. He also had some character flaws, and when your mother was in the nursing home, he had an affair with her friend, which is really like the ultimate betrayal, right?
Yeah.
And you struggled a lot with that, as I think any daughter would. You know, I tried to put myself in that situation. I would have been furious with my father. How did you come to resolution around that when he was having an affair with Louise and your mum is still alive and she's in this nursing home?
Well, the fury, unfortunately, I didn't have at the time because I don't think I was formed enough as an adult, even though I was an adult. I was used to my father. My father was very narcissistic, and I was used to believing him. And I couldn't really look at it objectively because I didn't think that Mother knew. I thought that she was so ill. I mean, she was so ill. There was no question about that. She was not going to live very long, and it was complicated by the fact that I liked Louise tremendously. She was a wonderful person, and I could understand why my father wanted to be with her. It wasn't until later that I realized that he had actually researched her wealth.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
So, you know, the brother didn't fall that far from the father tree, I'm afraid.
Right. What did you learn about yourself, Cornelia? Because at the heart of this also is trying to understand yourself and how you've been affected by the lives that you shared with your family.
I think the most wonderful thing I learned is that the one's history needs to be resolved. I needed to understand not only my mother, but my grandparents. I needed to understand the environment that I, as a little flower, the garden that I, as a little flower, had been planted in, so that I could understand the dynamics in my own life. And I've worked hard, really, all my life, I think, to become more mentally and physically healthy and to help others do that. And the writing of the book was a kind of flowering of that, a kind of, this is the fruit, this is what happens for me when I work hard on understanding myself and others.
I'm just going to ask you one last question, and that is, was it hard to actually sit down and write this? I know you said it took you many years. You had to do a lot of research, and I'm sure a lot of thought went into this too. How hard was it for you to write it?
I'd say it was tremendously hard. There were so many different versions. There were so many different titles because I had so much material, Vicki. And how was I to shape it? I think figuring out the shape of it and the emphasis on which part of the story was more important, that was really, really difficult. But luckily, I had no kind of deadline, and so I just, and because personally it meant so much to me, it also was a great pleasure.
Right.
To work that hard on it.
Right. Yeah, I can see that, because one of the things as a writer you always have to do, and as a filmmaker, any kind of creative project like that, you have to remember what's at the heart of my story, because there were many angles you could have taken on this.
Yes.
As that guy said to you, you know, you could have written about the brother. So many angles you could have taken, yeah. All right, well, I really appreciate you being with us today, Cornelia. I know listeners can find out more about you at corneliaspellman.com. A final thought you'd like to leave our listeners with?
I think I would just remind them that Spellman only has one L. most people put two L's. The thought I'd like to leave them with is how valuable it is to understand the stories, especially the stories that have not been told in our own families. We need to know them, and we need to understand them and to be able to talk to somebody trustworthy about them.
Yeah, and have the courage to delve into those stories.
No, we get courage from connection to others.
Yeah, awesome. Cornelia, it's been such a pleasure. The book is Missing. I really appreciate you being with us. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Vicki. Bye.
If you have questions, comments, or feedback regarding today's podcast, you can reach me on our website at conversationslive.net. Thanks for joining us today. We'll have a new podcast go live next Wednesday. Until then, live well, live strong.
Radio is very competitive. Shows soar in popularity and then flame out. Sometimes, however, a real connection is made with an audience, and success blooms year after year. For over a decade, Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair has built a loyal following thanks to inspiring and stimulating conversation. Longevity, loyalty, exclusivity. Smart advertisers seek it out. With Vicki's valuable audience, the search is over. Discover the affordable, effective ways to advertise your business. Log on to conversationslive.net. That's conversationslive.net today.